This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the show today. If trying to get ahead for you financially feels as though you're pedaling uphill, it seems you're not alone. Many Americans say that they feel worse off today than they did 5 or 10 years ago. So apart from the rising price of oil, which we all know is impacting us right now, what is going on with our economy and what real impact does that have on us as working Americans and on our lifestyle? My guest today is an expert at breaking down the financial jargon thrown around by politicians. He's Jared Bernstein, a senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Altogether Now and the co-author of 8 editions of The State of Working America. Bernstein's work has also been published in The American Prospect, Los Angeles Times, New York Times, New York Daily News. He's also featured weekly commentator on CNBC's Cudlow & Company and Morning Call and is regularly heard on NPR. Jared Bernstein's latest book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
We're pleased to have you here. I have so many questions, but before we get into that, I just want to share with our listeners how you approach economics, because you've been employed in economics since the early 1990s, but I believe your PhD is actually in social welfare. So what does that mean in terms of how you examine the economics?
It means I look at the economy from the perspective of social well-being, from the perspective of living standards. As a card-carrying economist who practices that particularly dark science in the halls of Washington, I'm very much interested in all the big macroeconomic indicators. I need to know how fast the economy is growing and the unemployment rate, inflation, Federal Reserve policy, trade imbalances. But that's not where I stop. Whereas equity and whereas efficiency is important to the economist side of me, I'm very much interested in equity and how the economy is playing out in the lives of everyday people. If the economy looks great from 50,000 feet, but not so good from Main Street, I want to know about it.
Mm. Now, you start out the book, you say, I'm tired of being stuck in the studio engaging in rants with Darth Vaders with PhDs. Wouldn't it be more useful to have an open-ended, rant-free dialogue with real, everyday people? Is that why you wrote this book?
Yes, I think the inspiration for Crunch came when I was on the set of some television show arguing about precisely the kinds of things we were just saying, where one economic elite or another would be saying, how could there be a problem? Productivity is up, inflation is low, unemployment is low, and overall aggregate GDP growth, the broadest economic measures are looking fine. How could there be a problem? And I was trying to point out, well, in fact, typical working families are falling behind, and real wages for many people behind inflation. And it just seemed like when you're talking about the economy these days, you have to ask yourself, whose economy is it that you're talking about? And mm-hmm. I don't always seem to be able to have that conversation in the halls of power.
Why is it that economists disagree so disparately? I mean, it's like you listen to one person, as you said, and, you know, it's all sunshine and roses, and so you listen to somebody else, and it's doom and gloom. It's already happened. It's already too late. We're already bankrupt. Why do they disagree so disparately, and who do we believe?
Well, the reason I think economists disagree are numerous. First of all, as your question should make everyone realize right off the bat, economics is not a hard science. This is not about, you know, immutable physical relationships as if we were talking about a physical science. Like the laws, you know, the so-called laws of economics are not like the laws of gravity. They're not laws at all. They're actually relationships that are changing all the time, having to do with the interaction of thousands of different economic agents, or people, if you'd rather, mm-hmm. and the way they interact with each other and with the economy. So that's one reason. It's often discussed as if it's really a science, but it's not at all like that. But secondly, there are a lot of economists who do the heavy lifting for folks who are trying to essentially steer the economy's growth their way. Not all, and there's lots of great economists out there who are highly ethical people, but there are also people who call themselves economists and, in fact, probably have economics degrees who are not particularly interested in a dispassionate assessment of where things are going, but are either ideologically tilted in a very conservative direction or are carrying water for people who essentially want to steer the economy's growth into their pocketbooks.
Mm. So I guess the first point of reference for us then is to know where they're coming from and who they represent. And
well, that's really the point of this book, Crunch. I mean, Crunch, if it works, and it's not for me to say if it does or not, but if Crunch works, it's really consumer education on economic policy.
Right, and you took a whole bunch of questions that people commonly ask and answered them in the book very directly here and in terms that did not put me to sleep, because a lot of economic books do that.
Mm-hmm.
You say that economics has been hijacked by the rich and powerful, and it's been forged into a tool that's being used against the rest of us. Do you really believe that?
Yes, and again, I don't want to get the dander up of perfectly good economists out there who are just plying their trade. But if you look at the debate here in Washington, for example, you will see economists and policymakers essentially explaining time and again why we can't do the things that many people believe we should do or even must do in order to rebalance the economy. So, for example, we have to cut taxes for rich people, yet cut benefits for poor people. We have to privatize Social Security. We can't have universal health care the way every other advanced economy does. Even unemployment insurance, we're told, is creates unacceptable incentives. Economists will tell you if you allow the Bush tax cuts to expire, as they're scheduled to do, even on the top end of the income scale, all kinds of terrible things will happen. And so, you know, the debate has been part of the debate. Again, I want to be pretty nuanced about this. Part of the debate has been hijacked by folks who have their own vested interests and will tell you in no uncertain terms that, hey, I wish it could be otherwise, but because of the rules of economics, we have to accept the outcomes of globalization as they are. We have to accept 50 million uninsured people. We have to accept the loss of jobs in recent months or declining real wages. That's just the way the cookie crumbles. And I do think that that is a very immoral exercise that has to be stopped.
And how do we go about stopping that? Huge question.
Well, in the chapter 5 of the book outlines what I call the reconnection agenda, which is a set of ideas to reconnect the growing economy. And in fact, this is not a dismal science story. In fact, the economy has many positive attributes. We've been highly productive. Right now, we're in something that looks a lot like a recession. And so, putting that cyclical downturn aside, this is an economy that's been highly productive. The problem is that the growth has flowed almost exclusively and solely to the top of the scale. So, what I'm trying to do is offer a set of policies, which I'm happy to articulate, but it takes a minute.
Let's get into that later then, and because you say right at the beginning of the book that if we feel squeezed, we are squeezed. It's because we are squeezed, and it's because mm-hmm. of inequality. So let's talk about inequality and what that means and how it's impacting us.
Mm-hmm. Sure. This is very much the outcome of this phenomenon I was just discussing, where the economy percolates along, generating solid growth rates, yet incomes for many of the folks, even the ones who are helping to generate those growth rates, fall behind. Right now, Right now we have, I'm sorry, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, sorry, I heard a weird noise on the phone.
That's okay. Live radio.
Okay. Right now we have a situation where 23% of all income is held by the top 1% of households. Now, let's put that number in perspective. 23% of all income held by the top 1%. If you go all the way back on the historical record, which goes back to 1913, you will find but one year where income was more highly concentrated among the top 1%, and that year is 1928, which did not end well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really do have an unusually and unsettling high amount of national income concentrated at the very top. And you know, this won't surprise probably many of our listeners. I mean, the top hedge fund manager last year earned $3.7 billion. And you know, when you have a distributional outcomes like that, they're simply going to be left less income flowing to the middle and the bottom.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that we're in a recession. And even though some people, again, argue that we're not.
Well, I didn't say we're in a recession. I said we're in something that certainly looks like a recession.
Right.
I mean, it's not for me to make the call.
So tell us what that looks like then.
Sure. I mean, first of all, and I write about this in the book, recessions are officially labeled well after the fact. The folks who end up telling us whether or not it was a recession wait for 6-12 months of data before they make the call. However, one thing to keep in mind is that, for example, we've lost employment for each of the last 4 months in a row. That is, every month over the last 4 months, we've had fewer jobs than the month before. That has never happened outside of a recession since the 1950s. So based on that one indicator alone, we're probably in a downturn. This will probably be ultimately labeled an official recession. But whether it is or not is wholly academic at this point. The fact is that the economy is growing very slowly. We know that. The economy is creeping along close to zero. And when the economy grows that slowly, it just doesn't generate enough economic activity to create the jobs and incomes that people need to lift their living standards. So that's where we are.
Okay. Now, I know that unemployment is a huge statistic that's used to measure across the board. I wonder, you know, what they don't tell us about unemployment. And the reason I raise this is because I know in England, some time ago when I used to live there, unemployment got very, very high. And so the government started counting unemployment differently. They stopped counting the homeless. They stopped counting the physically challenged who couldn't work. They stopped counting the disabled, mentally disabled. Is that how we count it here, or do we really count every single person who is unemployed?
Well, we count every single person who's unemployed, but we have a fairly narrow definition of who that is. You're only counted as being unemployed if you're actively seeking work. If you look for work for a couple of months and you say, you know what, there's just nothing out there, and I'm going to stop looking for a while, you're no longer counted. If you are, and this is particularly relevant right now, given where some of these numbers have been trending, if you're someone who can't find enough hours of work, so you are not unemployed, you're underemployed, you're not counted in the unemployment figures. But right now, for example, we've had a large spike in the number of involuntary part-time workers who'd rather work full-time. There's over 5 million of them right now.
So the companies are downsizing. Is that what you're saying? They're creating...
Well, they may not be downsizing, but they're cutting back people's hours. They're taking full-time workers and making them part-time. So it's a different kind of unemployment. It's really more under the rubric of underemployment. And if you put all those folks together, instead of a 5% unemployment rate, you're really looking at something more like a 9% underemployment rate.
Oh, interesting. And yeah. You say that's the real reason that our pockets are affected.
Right. I mean, I reference in that part of the crunch a period of the 1990s, which was actually really quite impressive. This book is not doom and gloom throughout, because if you go back not that long ago, you know, 10 years, you'll find that job markets were really very tight. And certainly there were some people who were underemployed, but many fewer than there were in the 2000s. And because of that, you created enough pressure in the job market such that employers had to bid up their wage offers, whether it's actual straight wages or compensation, including health or pension benefits. The benefits of growth were much more broadly shared because the economy was at something we call full employment. That is, most people who wanted a job had a good one, and you had this unique situation where you had employers kind of chasing workers instead of the other way around. It actually makes a big difference to how the benefits of growth are distributed.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jared Bernstein. His new book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Economic Mysteries. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, an encore presentation with consumer advocate and acclaimed environmentalist David Steinem, author of Diet for a Poisoned Planet and Safe Trip to Eden. Steinem joins Vicki to share what he learned on the environmental road trip across America. That's next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my special guest today is Jared Bernstein. He's written a new book called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Economic Mysteries. And I wanted to look, Jared, you know, each generation as it comes along hopes that, or assumes actually, we have the expectation that we're going to leave our kids in a better state than we lived and, you know, and pass on the legacy. Do you think, looking at the current state of things, that's going to happen this time around?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that that's a core, I think, component of what you might call the American dream. And in numerous polls, interestingly, that notion has been challenged. More than half of poll respondents are telling people they're worried that that might not be the case. And at one point when I was preparing for this research, I was doing focus groups, asking middle-class families in Indianapolis and Atlanta, places like that, what do you think? And people were quite anxious about this. It had to do with two main factors, I would say. It had to do with housing, and it had to do with, well, three really, housing, healthcare, and college education. In each one of those cases, people were worried that their kids wouldn't do as well as they did. Their kids wouldn't be as housed, as well housed, wouldn't have access to college, and wouldn't have access to as good health care as they did. And I think that they're absolutely right to worry about that. The housing market, of course, has been terribly imbalanced. It's undergoing what we call a big correction right now, which is basically what happens when a bubble bursts and gravity is reasserting itself on home prices. Health care, we're either going to get it wrong or we're going to get it right. And if we get it wrong, then those worries will be well-founded. And college education is absolutely a serious problem for middle-income families. The rate at which tuition is increasing is far, far surpassing paychecks. So families have reason to be worried about that stuff, but it's not inevitable that it won't work out.
Yeah, I think back to, you know, like when I was younger and everybody, they got engaged, they started saving for a house. By the time they were ready to get married, everybody bought their house. I didn't know anyone who didn't own their own home. And it seems to be getting harder for people to do today.
Well, the problem is that the prices of some of these core middle-class aspirational goods, if you will, the things that comprise the heart of really middle-class America, the prices of those goods are rising a lot faster than middle-class incomes, whether it's housing, healthcare, college tuition, in some cases child care. Basically, the kinds of quality of life issues have defined that kind of success, they've been slipping away because they've been growing much more faster than paychecks. Now, some other things have been growing, some other prices have been going the other way. You can buy, and I document this in the book. I mean, you have much better electronic goods than you ever could buy. Computer power is a lot cheaper, and that's helpful, but it's not at the core.
Right. Right. You share a story in the book about when you bought your speakers and you'd saved forever for the stereo system. And it's true. We do have a lot of stuff that's very accessible now that had not used to be.
Well, it's one of the benefits of globalization. I mean, I try to tell a pretty nuanced story about that. Globalization has some steep costs, but it also has some obvious benefits on the price side.
Well, that's a good segue because I wanted to talk about this next. And what do we mean by globalization, first of all?
Sure. I think a simple definition is the increased rate at which goods, ideas, bits and bytes, and people, money, the increased rate at which all of those flow across the globe and across borders.
Okay, and I want to ask a question that, you know, I have a hard time understanding because, again, I've heard very disparate viewpoints on this. I work with a lot of companies that offshore work. They outsource work to India and China and, you know, other countries. How is that impacting us? How does it get down to the average working American? How does it impact us?
Well, you know, it's not a big head scratcher. I mean, the way that impacts us is it puts downward pressure on the incomes and, to some extent, the economic security of affected people. Basically, if you are in an industry or an occupation where the stuff that you do can be digitized or routinized or sent somewhere to other people who also happen to have the capacity to do what you do, but at one-tenth the wage rate, you're now competing in a new market. And we've seen this put downward pressure on the wages of many workers here, even those with white collars. And that's what's interesting and new, and I think, you know, obviously concerning about this. If you are more exposed to this type of global competition, depending on what it is you do, your job doesn't have to be offshore for you to feel its impact. The potential or the threat of offshoring is enough to give you essentially less bargaining clout when you negotiate your wage.
Right. But, you know, it's...
So let me just give you a concrete example. I mean, one of the things we found, you will hear policymakers, for example, say, boy, what you really need in today's world is a college education. You get a college education, you're home free. Well, college-educated workers, their wages went up less than 3% in the 2000s. You know, if you go from 2000 to 2007, 7 years, you know, less than 3% in real terms. So, you know, part of that, not all of it, but part of that has to do with exactly this kind of threat effect from offshoring.
Right. And, you know, because I just put out a call, for example, let's give another example here. I just put out a call for some design work on a big project we're doing. And we had the normal bids come back, which, if I were to break it down per hour, are between about 100, 150 an hour. And then I had a whole bunch come in from offshore, which were $8 an hour and $7 an hour. And, you know, It's very hard for people here to compete against, very hard for them to compete against that.
Well, precisely. And so that kind of competing bid just wasn't part of the equation, really, you know, even 7 or 8, 9, 10 years ago.
Mm. So what's your overall viewpoint on offshoring then?
Well, my viewpoint on offshoring is much the same as that of globalization. I mean, this is I think in Japanese, someone once told me that the word for a crisis is the same as the word for opportunity. I think it's a huge challenge, and I think it's an opportunity. One of the things that you experience when you get those extra bids is, or for that matter, when in my book, when I go shopping for a music system and find out that it's about one-fifth as expensive as I thought it would be, is that you have the opportunity for faster economic growth. I think these lower prices that we face, and remember, you know, one person on one side of the equation, it's a lower wage; on the other side of the equation, it's a lower price. So these lower prices have benefits on the growth side, but have steep costs on the wage or living standard side. They're also all over the inequality story, because one of the reasons we have such inequality right now is that globalization helps to boost profits a lot more than it does boost the bargaining clout of most workers. So you have to take the benefits of the growth and plow them into offsetting the costs of the downside. You use the upside to correct the downside. So, for example, I mentioned earlier that there are many constraints facing middle-class families, often around the big-ticket items: housing, healthcare, college. We need to craft a policy response that takes that into account. Universal healthcare is an obvious example. Let's take some of the benefits of globalization and invest them in a better healthcare system, which provides needed healthcare for lots of people who don't have it, but which also manages that, you know, that whole really kind of out of control industry.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we have many investment needs that are going unmet in this economy, having to do with infrastructure and whether it's schools, roads, bridges. We could be making those investments, offsetting some of the losses that in terms of labor demand that globalization brings us.
Mm-hmm. So does the same principles apply to NAFTA, the free trade agreement, when companies, you know, they get tax breaks, or they in different states, or they move companies, factories over the border in Mexico, for example?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that in some cases these are no-brainers. I mean, the idea that you would give a company a tax break for relocating elsewhere, that's simply just the work of some nefarious lobbyist, and that kind of thing has to be stopped. You know, on the other hand, as I say in the book, I don't think there's that much of a relationship between trade agreements and globalization. I mean, globalization is going to keep growing apace whether or not we have any more trade agreements. These trade agreements tend to just be, at this point, kind of too often basically kind of a how you're going to divide up the spoils between investors on this side of the deal and on this side of the border and the other side of the border. NAFTA's been a failure, in my view, not because it's, you know, hurt the American workforce as much as it has failed to help the Mexican one.
Mm-hmm.
And these trade deals, again, you know, they're not really taking into account the needs of workers on either side of the equation. So I view the trade deals much more as documents that talk about, you know, how you're going to divvy up the spoils, and the problem is that it's too rare that working people themselves are represented at that table.
Yeah. While we're talking about that, let's talk about immigration. Of course, I myself, obviously, was an immigrant at some point. I've been a U.S. citizen for 15 years. I've lived in the States for 23 years. How does immigration affect the average working man? How do you, you know, when people argue, well, they're taking jobs from naturalized Americans?
Well, you know, it's the toughest thing I argue about, because so many people have had, you know, direct experience feeling like they've been hurt by immigrant competition. At this point, you know, it's hard to make a case that immigrants are taking jobs from native-born workers. If anything, they're taking jobs more, you know, it's new immigrants taking jobs from older immigrants. However, there was a time when industries that are largely dominated by immigrants now used to be dominated by native-born workers, and those industries, those jobs were better jobs back then. And you could look at meatpacking. You could look at construction. That's not the fault of immigrants by any means. It's basically a situation where these jobs were, the quality of these jobs were significantly diminished, and you had to find someone to fill them. And who's going to fill those jobs? Someone who's pretty desperate for work. So I don't, you know, I think the problems facing immigrants right now are the problems facing, are largely the problems facing any low-wage worker, regardless of their, of where they were born. Basically, we have a very serious problem of job quality at the low end of the labor market, and it so happens that many of the folks filling those jobs are immigrants. Mm.
Let's talk about another huge issue. Let's talk about healthcare. You say in the book, let me just paraphrase you here, you say that healthcare costs so much because consumers don't face the costs and we have insatiable demands. Explain what you mean by that.
Right. I talk about healthcare kind of like it's a buffet, all you can eat, except for you never get full. We don't, either on the supply side or the demand side, there are almost no constraints if you have coverage. And of course, if you lack coverage, then you face nothing but constraints. People seeking health care, people like you and me seeking health care, will typically want, you know, all we can get. People providing health care have an incentive to provide us with everything they can throw at us because that's how they get paid. And there's very little kind of cost effectiveness going on either side of the equation. The only group out there trying to block, get between you and the healthcare you need is typically the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And you know, their motivation is to block folks from getting the care in many cases that they need, want, and have paid for. So it's a pretty dysfunctional system. And it's especially so when viewed in the light that, you know, every other advanced economy has figured out how to square that circle and has done so with some combination of much more regulated cost controls and universal coverage, that is, making sure everyone's covered. The reason you do that is because the larger the risk pool, the more you have, the more you're able to have healthy people subsidize sick people. That's the way healthcare works. You have to cut the inefficiencies that go on in the insurance system out of the equation. And once you do that, and it sounds real easy when I put it this way, but once you do that, the experience of most other countries, I mean, really every other advanced economy, is that they provide health care to all their citizens for a half to two-thirds of the cost that we do, and they do so with better health outcomes.
Wow.
But they do a lot more on the cost effectiveness. Somebody just told me the other day, a knowledgeable person in the industry told me that 40% of cardiac splints, which I guess is some kind of a splint you put in when you have a heart problem, 40% of cardiac splints are ineffective. Back surgery, of which we do a ton of, is often ineffective and has had, you know, almost no serious investigation of whether it's useful or not. More often than not, the health care that we're providing is the result of interested parties who simply make a lot of money when you provide that kind of health care. And that's the perfect formula for wasting a lot of much-needed resources.
Mm. I you mentioned Michael Moore's film in the book, Sicko. What did you think of that?
Well, I thought that was... I think I mentioned a moment in the film where I think Michael Moore says to somebody, why would you want to be part of a universal system where you have to pay, you know, where you have to pay for my health care? You know, we all kind of subsidize each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said something, well, because that's what I'd want you to do for me. And for me, it was a real, you know, we're in this together moment, which is interesting in both that it speaks to a kind of very different approach to economics, which in the book I call yo-yo economics, which is you're on your own. which is much more the way we've approached economic policy. A we're in this together approach is interesting because I think it has positive benefits both, you know, kind of spiritually, but B, in the terms of healthcare, it's actually a lot more efficient. Again, in a healthcare system, in a country like ours with millions and, you know, really tens and hundreds of millions of healthy people and, you know, some sick people too, if you pool that kind of risk of illness across our population, you save a lot of resources. So the kind of we're in this together approach that I thought Sicko was kind of underlining is good both on many levels.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We're talking today with Jared Bernstein. His new book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws Foster Care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with Jared Bernstein. His book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. I wanted to ask you this, Jared, because I've read this and then I've read denials on it. Maybe you can answer this. I keep hearing that we borrow money from China every single day. Others say, no, we don't. Are we or are we not?
Yes, we do. We borrow a lot of money from China. Interestingly, it's money that they have because we buy their goods. We have something called the big trade deficit with China. That means that we buy a lot more from them than they buy from us. And so we buy when we buy Chinese goods, we send our dollars to China. China, in fact, has about $1 trillion, you know, literally a trillion of our dollars, maybe not sitting around in paper banks somewhere, but on paper they have $1 trillion dollars in reserve, and that comes from this trade deficit. What they then do is you can't consume more than you produce without incurring some debt. So we are indebted to China, and they lend us those dollars back, typically borrowing some kind of bonds from us. They buy bonds from us, they lend us that money back, and then we buy more of their stuff. So we kind of have this bit of a shell game going on.
Okay, so let's talk about the deficit we have now, because if we're, it seems like we're just getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Because, again, I've heard both sides of the story, and I think you talk about that in the book, too.
Yeah, I think it's not at all a bad thing to have a deficit. I talk in the book mostly about a federal budget deficit, and I think deficits get a bad rap. You say the same thing about a trade deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need to borrow. The question is, what are you borrowing for? If you are borrowing to make a productive investment that will help you do better in the future, then that's good borrowing. If you're borrowing to fritter away money on consumption that is not in your interest, or for that matter, you know, wasteful spending on health care, that's by definition wasteful. So, for example, myself, maybe you, certainly a lot of our listeners probably took loans out to go to college. Well, at the same thing, you know, governments can borrow in order to invest in productive infrastructure. Education is a great example. Schools, roads, highways, communication systems, water systems, in offsetting environmental degradation, all of that are smart things to invest in, and if that means borrowing, that's fine. Now, you have to be mindful of the rate at which you're borrowing. As long as the economy is growing quickly enough to pay off those debts, that's okay, too. So it's not that borrowing is bad. It's that I think you need to be mindful of what it is you're borrowing for.
Yeah, and I think it sounds so bad to say we're so many trillion in debt. The other thing, of course, is, you know, they've had this horrific earthquake in China, and now we're sending funds over for that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't, because those people definitely need help.
Well, let's get down to cases. Let's get down to cases, Vicky. Here, listen to this.
Yeah.
In the case of the last 7 years, I'm just looking at the budget under Bush. We've increased our national debt by about $4 trillion. It's gone from about $5 trillion to about $9 trillion. So again, your knee-jerk reaction might be, oh, that sounds terrible. But not necessarily. Let's look at what that debt is from. Well, 46% of that debt is from the Bush tax cuts. About 30% of that debt is from defense spending and the war. Now, if you believe, as I do, that cutting taxes, especially in time of war, and financing a war exclusively by borrowing doesn't make a lot of sense, then that would be bad debt. And that gets you to, 70-plus percent of our indebtedness. So that's an example, I think, of really profligate borrowing.
Okay. So then when we're borrowing all this money, where is it coming from other than we've got the tax cuts? And, where else is it coming from?
We're borrowing money from anyone who will lend it to us. Much of it comes from abroad, and some of it comes from folks here. When you hear people talking about treasury bills or T-bills, those are IOUs from the government to anyone who will lend it money.
Okay. Let's talk about pay a little. How do we come up with the median pay? I hear people say, the average wage. I think I'm not quite sure what the numbers are right now, but we have this median wage, and people say this is so far off, it's not even funny.
Well, I mean, the median is what it is. I mean, the median is just a measure of the 50th percentile of any distribution. So if you line up every worker in America from the lowest paid to the highest paid, and you take that worker right in the middle, in the 50th percentile, that's going to be your median. And the median wage right now is probably all around $15 or something like that. The median household income, that's in the mid-40s. So, you can argue that that's not enough to get by on, and I'd be right with you in lots of cases, but that is the median.
And so why don't we value our teachers enough to pay them more? Why don't we value our healthcare workers enough to pay them more?
Well, that's really important, especially vis-a-vis teachers. The healthcare discussion is similar, but in the case of teachers, many of them are paid through the public sector. And so you really could ask yourself, why don't we value our teachers more and pay them more? And the answer would get you pretty quickly back into how teachers are financed, which is, of course, through taxes. And we have been through, I would argue, a very intense tax revolt in this country over the past, I don't know how many years, 10, 15 years. The idea that you could go forth and say, I believe teachers should be paid better and it's going to involve a tax increase, would get, theoretically get you laughed out of the house. And so that's one of the constraints right there. But also, and I stress this in the book when I answer that question, I think I ask, why a teacher is a college-educated worker, mm-hmm. A hedge fund manager is a college-educated worker. Why does one, tend to make in the millions and the other scrape, really having a tough time in the middle of the, 40, 50, maybe $60,000 range? And the answer has to do with the coin of the realm. I mean, teachers, it's in our economy, it's hard for us to assess the value added from teaching. We that hedge fund manager, him or herself, probably had a great math teacher somewhere back there. But we don't connect those dots very effectively. And so it's extremely hard to think about how much value teachers add, especially when you recognize that they're pushing back against all of these inequality trends we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Far too often in our society, we say, okay, everything's really kind of screwed up on the inequality front, but teachers, you got to fix it. And, you know, that's ridiculous. Many kids come to school having faced really the kind of economic repression that we've been talking about, and they're obviously far less ready to learn than many other kids. So teachers have a very, very hard job, and we don't value it nearly effectively enough.
Right, and especially when, I just want to paraphrase something you said in the book, and that is that one thing that economists do agree on is that the best, if not the only way to get out of the current squeeze is for more people to get more education, and yet then we don't put the emphasis on valuing our teachers.
Well, you're right, and I don't want to sound, you know, overly romantic about this. I'm sure you could find teachers who are not doing their job, just like in any other occupation.
Oh, sure.
But the problem is the ones who are, and my experience is that's most of them. We're not remunerating them the way we need to. I mean, just the other night I gave a book talk, and this woman came up to me afterwards, a teacher, local middle school, and really, you know, hasn't had a pay raise in numerous years. And that, as I said earlier, that's awfully tough when the prices around you are going up as quickly as they are.
Yeah. Well, let's answer this big question, which is on many people's minds, and that's Social Security, because, again, we hear disparate viewpoints on that. Yes, it's going to be there. Don't worry about it. No, it's not going to be there. You'd better start preparing.
Yeah, it is going to be there, and the notion that it's not is one of the most effective and, I think, really misleading misinformation campaigns within the last 20 years. There are a lot of well-heeled folks with vested interests, particularly training their sights on millions of private accounts, who would love to see Social Security privatized so that personal retirement accounts would replace that and everybody would be an investor and they could collect handsome fees. And in fact, in the book, I suggest that there are ways to inject the benefits of stock market investment into Social Security, but you don't need to privatize the system. Social Security is actually in pretty good financial health in the following regard. First of all, tomorrow's retirees will actually get higher benefits than today's retirees, even if we do nothing. But to fix the program, to make it actuarially sound over the 75-year period with which we make that evaluation, would be a relatively light lift, especially compared to, say, the healthcare challenge. For example, if we were to let the Bush tax cut sunset, we could easily pay for Social Security, but not the whole Bush tax cuts, simply the top 1% of the Bush tax cuts. That's what it would cost to make that program whole again. And as I said, even were we not to fix it, it still would be in relatively good shape. So that's been largely a smear campaign.
Interesting. I was watching the Today Show this morning, a little news segment, and they were talking about baby boomers and how many of them are having to dip into their IRAs and retirement plans to pay just for gas and food. What do you see as the biggest challenge for baby boomers in this economy?
Well, again, as I said earlier, when you talk about the economy, it really matters whose economy you're talking about. I mean, there are baby boomers who we don't have to worry about, and there are lots of us. I'm a baby boomer, so I can say us. And there are lots of folks in our age range who do. I mean, the reason they're dipping into those funds to pay for necessities has a lot to do with the current squeeze that's on right now that we've been talking about. The economy may or may not be in recession, but it's growing far too slowly to generate the kinds of economic activities in terms of income and jobs that we need. So people are falling behind. And I think we haven't talked about this. I think this is at the heart of it. Many folks haven't been saving much at all. I mean, save something in their pension funds, but savings have been way down in part because homes were appreciating. And so you kind of felt like, well, I'm getting wealthier from this house that's worth, you know, $1,000 more every 2 weeks, so I don't have to worry about savings. Well, of course, you know, that bubble burst, and it's coming back down to earth. And so that kind of source of savings is gone. And so, yeah, I can imagine people dipping into those sources, even though that's really, you know, not what you want to do.
Mm. Presidents, and especially this one, it seems, seem to sometimes distance themselves from the economy as though they have no responsibility for it. Tell us what their responsibility is, how much influence they do have.
Well, I think, you know, they tend to be right there when the economy turns up, nowhere near the scene of the crime when it goes the other way. So, you know, that's, you know, not just this one, but all presidents do that. Presidents, you know, it's funny. I mean, I could think the typical economist will often say, you know, presidents can't do anything about the economy. I think that's wrong. I mean, I think there are three areas where presidents have a lot of impact. One has to do with helping to get the economy back on track when it stumbles. So right now we've had this stimulus package that is very much crafted by the Bush administration. A second function is the redistributive one. This president has kind of played Robin Hood in reverse with tax cuts that have delivered far, far greater benefits to the top end than the middle or low. I mean, middle-income families ended up about $1,000 better off from these tax cuts. That is, their tax liabilities were lowered by about $1,000 if you're in the, say, $40,000 to $60,000 range. If you're up there in the millions or even in the hundreds of thousands, you know, your tax liability was cut by $50,000 to $100,000. So, you know, that's kind of Robin Hood in reverse. So, mm-hmm. But presidents can go the other way on that. Clinton actually kind of played more of the traditional Robin Hood role there by cutting taxes on lower income people. Bush turned that around. And finally, and I think this is in some ways the most important, is presidents set the regulatory environment. Presidents have a lot to say about how we regulate industries, whether it's financial industries, mortgage markets, workplaces. And again, I think the Bush administration has had a very, very much a hands-off you're on your own, a yo-yo approach to that sort of thing.
Right. When we hear the term stagflation, what does that mean?
Stagflation is a situation where two things that are not supposed to be happening at the same time happen, and that's inflation and unemployment. Increasing inflation usually occurs when the economy is heating up and unemployment is falling. But imagine a situation where unemployment is rising, which usually means the economy is weakening, mm-hmm. which ought to lead to slower price growth or slower inflation, but in fact you get faster inflation. That's stagflation, where you have rising unemployment and rising inflation, two variables that are supposed to go the opposite way at times like that.
Okay. Now, the book, as you said, is not all doom and gloom. There's some very positive stuff in there. So I wonder, what is your overall viewpoint right now, today? Because I know it may change tomorrow.
Yes, good question. Yeah, it's like the weather. My viewpoint today is actually quite a positive one. In fact, if listeners are interested, they might want to look at this piece I posted on the Huffington Post called It's Our Turn. Everything we've been talking about for the last hour, maybe, you know, well known to you and me, but it's also, and now to our listeners, but it's also well known in one way or another to many people out there in the electorate. This was my experience touring around talking about this book. These imbalances, the fact that families have been working harder, smarter, falling behind while income has been so concentrated at the top, tax breaks that are so tilted the wrong way, this deregulatory environment that's allowed capital markets to go completely off the rails and bring the economy down with it, all of these contradictions and these problems are pretty well known to folks right now. And in the current political debate, one side, McCain, is largely saying, you know, promoting business as usual. And the other side, whether it's Obama or Clinton, is talking about a different approach. Now, I know this sounds really partisan, and I don't mean to be partisan. I would absolutely support Republicans over Democrats if I thought, you know, that was the way it lined up. What my point is, and the reason I'm hopeful, is that the deficiencies of the model we've been following are just excruciatingly clear. And my hope is that that would, you know, herald in a very different way of approaching the economy.
Okay, sounds good. Jared Bernstein, I really thank you for being with us today. Great information, great book. It's called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed and Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky.
And I want to thank each of you for listening in today. You can reach me at conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Please join me next Monday at noon. Until then, live well, live strong, and we'll talk to you next week.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, an encore presentation with consumer advocate and acclaimed environmentalist David Steinem, author of Diet for a Poisoned Planet and Safe Trip to Eden. Steinem joins Vicky to share what he learned on the environmental road trip across America. That's next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Views expressed.